See you here today. A lot of people aren't here. I was going to say something mean, but let it go. Just let it go. Just let it go. Hey, we're starting financial freedom class in a couple of weeks. Actually, 3 weeks from today. No, actually, 2 weeks from today. That's a great series. It's a Dave Ramsey series, and it'll be led by Lyndall Nero Harper. We hope that that you'll sign up. It's their sign-up sheet is in the lobby, and sign up today. You know, when I came here as your pastor, this is a great church. It was a little different than where I'd pastored before, because if you put a sign-up sheet out in North Carolina, you get 80% of the people that's going to show up the first Sunday. It's like, we're going to have this, and we want you to sign up, and maybe they all think there's limited spaces, so they all sign up, and it's like, take this and multiply by 20%, and we're good. And I remember coming here, and we had something, and it's like three people signed up. The last Sunday to sign up, it was like 30 people signed up. It's like, so don't do that. It's irritating. So you got 2 or 3 weeks to sign. 2 weeks to sign up for financial freedom. That's going to be on Sunday night. Also, starting on the 16th, the bowling league starts. We have about 10 or 12 spots left. And so if you want in on that, you got to get in really soon, or the league is going to close. It's good to have you here today. I want to talk to you about depression, or when Christians get the blues. Now, I say Christians because if you're not a Christian, I don't know what to say to you. You're on your own. Hard enough if you got Jesus. If you ain't got Jesus, you're on your own. Find you some really good medicine and take twice what they tell you to take is all I can tell you. No, don't do that. I'm not telling you to do that. But I want to talk to Christians about getting the blues. Christmas is a time of great joy, but it's also a time of great struggle for people. And to be quite frank with you, I struggle at Christmas in ways I don't struggle the rest of the year. I tell people, my birthday's in May. I don't feel a year older in May. I feel a year older on the last day of the year. It's like I'm a little bit closer to death. Even as I speak, it's the last day of the year. It's going fast. My years are going as fast as my hair. Now it's fleeting, and so I feel older. The days are shorter. You know, 5:30 feels like 8:30, and then you know you see your family, and some of you are again faced with the dysfunction that's in your family. Others are faced with the empty chairs at the table in your family. You know, my family met at my mom's. Dad's been gone 2 years after everybody cleared out. And even during that time, there's a lot of activity. But after everybody cleared out, it just seemed like everywhere I looked, there was Dad. And you missed those people that were particularly patriarchs in the family at Christmas. And it's a reminder that they're not there, that those seats are not there. In fact, I was thinking about Isaiah chapter 9, verse 2. This is a great Christmas verse. It says, "The people who walked in darkness have seen a great light. Those who dwelt in the land of the shadow of death, upon them a light has shined." Now, that's supposed to be positive, and the light has shined, but sometimes it's line 3 there, yet get the sense you dwell in the land of the shadow of death. And sometimes it seems like the light isn't shining as much as it does at other times. And the sense that all is not well, that the party's coming to an end. Merry Christmas, by the way. That the party's coming to an end. It just starts to seep into your life. I have a daughter that has always been, almost since she could talk, more sensitive to death than the other children. And so last week I was listening, and this is a common occurrence with us. This is an every week kind of occurrence. I was listening to a song, and Bing Crosby came on, and I said, "Oh, there's Bing Crosby." And she says, "Is he dead?" It's like, "Well, he's dead." And all the week before, it's like, "You know that episode of Perry Mason we were watching?" It's like, "Yeah." And then there's Perry Mason, and "Yeah." And she says, "Is he dead?" It's like, "Well, yeah, that was 50 years ago. He was morbidly obese then. He's not alive." No. You got to think through these things. But she's fascinating. We were in Washington with the girls, the two older ones. Two younger ones hadn't been thought about yet. But we were in a museum. We only had time to go to two. We went to the aeronautical. Is that it? Aeronautical? Yeah. Is that a word? We went to the museum with the airplanes, and then we went to the other museum with the dinosaurs, and we were in about the third floor, and I was behind them about 5 feet, and one said to the other, "I wish we could leave. There ain't nothing in here that's alive." And that's the truth. We thought they'd be impressed with the dinosaurs. They were just overwhelmed by the sense that everything's dead in this place. And maybe you're there. I mean, it seems like the holidays bring that out in us. And so I want to talk to you about the blues, about depression. I should define depression. I never do. Let me give you is this a Wikipedia? Everything on Wikipedia may not be true, but here's depression. It is the persistent feeling of sadness or the loss of interest that characterizes major depression can lead to a range of behavioral physical symptoms that include changes in sleep, appetite, energy level, concentration, daily behavior, self-esteem, and can be associated with thoughts of suicide. I want to talk to you about some of the things the Bible says to you and I who may find this to be easily besetting. Now, let me say at the offset, if your doctor tells you you need to take medicine, take your medicine. And I'm not on depression medicine now. I have been at periods of time in my life. Take your medicine. I tell people it's an act of love because people have to live with you. So take your medicine as an act of love. Pray you'll get healed, but until you get healed, take your medicine, because people, again, have to live in the same house as you got to live in. But having said that, there's also a spiritual component to depression. So let me read to you from 1 Kings chapter 19. This passage will be familiar to many of you, so I won't belabor it. Verse 13, "So it was when Elijah heard it." So Elijah's in a cave. Let me see if I can say this in 30 seconds. Elijah's the prophet. Ahab, Jezebel are the king and queen. They are introducing pagan worship into the nation. The nation is quickly following after false gods. Elijah challenges the prophets of Baal and other false prophets to a showdown on Mount Carmel. God definitively, and with an exclamation mark, shows that he's the true God. And so after that, Elijah thinks there'll be a great revival in the nation. God has definitively spoken. He goes to Jezreel, the capital, for the revival to begin. Nobody seems excited. It doesn't matter that God has proven that he's the true God. Everything's going on as normal. And Jezebel says, I'm gonna kill you by the end of the day. So Elijah runs. The people go after Elijah. Elijah hides in the cave. While he's in the cave, God comes to him, and this is a conversation. So in verse 13, "So it was when Elijah heard," and verse 12 talks about how God came in the earthquake, the fire, and then a still small voice. So verse 13, "So it was when Elijah heard it that he wrapped his face in his mantle and went out and stood at the entrance of the cave, and suddenly a voice came to him and said, 'What are you doing here, Elijah?' And so he said, 'I have been very zealous for the Lord of hosts, because the children of Israel have forsaken your covenant, torn down your altars, and killed your prophets with your sword. I alone am left, and they seek to take my life.' No, you get that, verse 14. That's depression. Everybody who matters is dead. Everybody that I care about is gone. I alone am left. And I would rather not live. Everything I care about is meaningless to me, or it's gone, and I wish I could go and join those who have gone on. That's verse 14. But verse 15, then the Lord said to him, go, return on your way to the wilderness of Damascus, and when you arrive, anoint Hazael as king over Syria, and you shall anoint Jehu the son of Nimshi as king over Israel, and Elisha the son of Shaphat of Abel-Meholah, who shall anoint, you shall anoint as a prophet in your place. It shall be that whoever escapes the sword of Hazael, Jehu will kill, and whoever escapes the sword of Jehu, Elisha will kill. And yet I have reserved 7,000 in Israel. Now that's almost surely a symbolic number, by the way. Seven is a number of completion. 1,000 is generally used in the Bible to mean lots. So I think God's not saying it's just 7,000. He's saying it's lots of people in Israel, all whose knees have not bowed to Baal and every mouth that has not kissed him. And so he departed from there and found Elisha, the son of Shaphat, who was plowing with 7 yoke of oxen before him, and he was with the 12th. And then Elisha passed by him and threw his mantle on him. And he left the oxen and ran after Elisha and said, please let me kiss my father and mother, and then I will follow you. And he said, go back again, for what have I done to you? And so Elisha turned away from him and took a yoke of oxen and slaughtered and boiled their flesh and used the oxen's equipment and gave it to the people, and they ate. And then he arose and followed Elisha and served him. First point I want you to see, and that is that when God comes to Elisha, who's in this very depressed state, this very down place, he says, get up, go. Now, God is very gracious to Elijah. And we didn't read the passages, but earlier it says that God sent Elijah an angel to cook for him for 2 or 3 days. So God is very compassionate to Elijah. He sees that there's a physical issue. He sends an angel to address the physical. He lets Elijah get strength. He lets Elijah sort of recuperate. And God, again, is addressing him at the end in a still, small voice. God loves him. God sympathizes. God understands. And the Bible says that's true for you and I. Hebrews 4:15 says that we don't come to a high priest who cannot sympathize with us, but was in all points tested as we are, but yet without sin. Emphasis there is on God sympathizes with us. 1 Peter 5:7 says we ought to cast all our care on him, for he cares for us. So God is not short on grace and mercy and sympathy in regards to people like you and I. But having said that, God comes to him and says, Elijah, you can't stay in the cave. You want to stay in the cave. You just want to get in here and die. But if you stay in the cave will become your tomb. You got to get out of the cave. Get up, go. You can't stay where you are. And I speak again as a person who has dealt with some of this in my life. The easiest thing in the world is for a person who has issues regarding depression to justify that depression. It's very easy for us to say, I think more than other people, why are you telling me to get over it? You have no idea what I've been through. You have no idea what I'm going through. It's the most insensitive thing in the world to tell somebody like me that you got to do something with yourself. And we're very resistant to that. And yet, you and I both know that in every other avenue of life, regardless of why a person got into a place that they are in, they bear great responsibility for getting out of that place too. I mean, you look at somebody in a financial hole and they tell you what's going on. They say, listen, I grew up, my parents didn't have any money. I was stupid. I ran up credit cards. I went out, I started a business, and the business was prospering, and then the economy went under, and so I lost my business, and then my wife left me, and all I got is this fishing pole. She took it all. Never left. And you say, I feel your pain. But you also haven't worked in 6 months, and there's jobs all over town. I mean, I feel your pain, but you still got to do something about it. I mean, we may look at a person and say, I mean, we're the hardest on people with addictions. And because we'll look at a person with addiction and say, listen, I know you were molested as a baby. I know you have pain that nobody can touch. I understand. I can't understand, but I cannot imagine what you've been through. I know you've lost people. There is devastation in your life. But you still can't go home and snort cocaine. You still have some responsibility for doing something about your case, even though I can't fathom the pain. You still can't be self-destructive. But we look at marriages and say, you know what? I realize what you married. I wouldn't have married what you married. You should have asked somebody before you married him. I wouldn't have done that. But, and I realize you got all kinds of issues. But you still can't be yelling and screaming at each other all the time. You still have some responsibility, even though you're in a bad marriage, and God bless you. Even though it's horrible, you still got some responsibility to try to help the thing get better. And if you have depression, when I have depression, just because I have it doesn't mean I don't have some responsibility to try to get better. And to not be self-destructive. I still have responsibilities. People still have to live with me. And so, when God comes to Elijah, the first thing he says is, you can't stay in the cave. You gotta get up. I mean, I get that you want to stay there. I get that you're grieving. I get the loss. I get that you think you're the only one alive and there's nobody there. I get that the nation has gone to, you know what? I get all that, but you still have some responsibility to help yourself get up. And then secondly, he says not only get up, but he says get busy. He says, Elijah, I'm still working in this nation. I've got the domino set up. I got the king Assyria. I got this king anointed. And then I got Elisha picked out. The dominoes are in place. I'm still working. And this nation still needs its prophet. And I'm telling somebody here today, your children still need their parent. Your grandchildren still need their grandparents. That class still needs its teacher. Your church still needs you, because we need greeters and choir members and teachers and people who will call and check on people. We need accountability folks. We need folks out there at Locust Springs real soon. We need folks in the daycare. Your church needs you. The work of God hasn't stopped just because you're not filling up the par. And so he says to Elijah, you got to get up. You got to get out. You got to get up. You got to get busy with your life. And then he says, and also Elijah, you got to get connected. I know you feel all alone, but I got Elisha. You need to get out of the cave. You need to take up the mantle again. You need to do what I've called you to do. And I've got somebody picked out for you that's going to be a constant partner for you. Elisha, he's going to be your associate. And he's going to be with you the rest of your life. And he's going to be a help to you. Now, I am a classic introvert. You say, well, you don't seem shy. It has nothing to do with whether you're shy or not. I'll tell you what's wrong with you. I'm not shy. Introvert and extrovert, about one-third of the population is introvert, about two-thirds is extrovert. Probably can't guess what Kim Trantham is. It'd be hard to guess. I'm an introvert. And it's all about where you get your energy from. An extrovert feeds off relations with people. An introvert is recharged. It's like we all have this battery. And the longer I'm around people, the more my battery goes down. And so the way I charge my battery is I'm alone. That's why Mondays are important to me. It's my day off. Don't call me. If they're going to die, but they're not going to die till Tuesday, call me Tuesday. I was joking with somebody. I said, when I first started here, I told people, that is the nicest, craziest church. They know my day off and they don't call. That is the best trained congregation I know of. I just didn't realize everybody didn't have my cell phone yet. But I need to recharge. Okay. And introverts, we feed off being alone. It's how we come out with energy. Now again, if you're an extrovert, you come home and if it's been a tough day, it's like I'm going to Applebee's. I got to be around people. You know. Well, if you're an introvert, you come home, or an extrovert, you got to go Applebee's. If you're an introvert, you come home and it's like, hey, everybody clear out of this living room. I got to watch TV for 2 hours. I don't want to be interrupted either. Just got to get it back. And that's why when I do premarital counseling anymore, it's like one of the big areas I look at is, are you an introvert or an extrovert? Because if you are an extrovert, you better know what you're getting if they're an introvert. Or else you're going to feel rejection. Because they're going to come home and it's going to be, and you're going to be there and it's like, let's go to eat, let's go do stuff. And they're going to say, I don't want to talk about my day. Give me some space. And if you're an extrovert, it's like, I don't understand that at all. And you're going to be calling your mother and crying. And it's like, I can't believe what. No, he's just an introvert. He's not grouchy. If you'll give him the space, he'll be delightful again in no time. But here's the thing. If you're an introvert, what do you do when you feel tired or weak or down? You go to bed. It's like, I feel down. Turn off these lights. I'm going to bed. When I wake up, I'll feel better. And then you go to sleep and you wake up and you don't feel better. And it's like, I'll have a cup of coffee and I'll go back to sleep. And I'll see if it works again. And it's hard for an introvert to hear, you got to get out and get around people. Because that is against everything that has got us to this point. Throughout our entire life, what we know is if it's bad, if we get away, it'll get better. And what God is saying to Elijah, it's like, no, you stay in that cave too long, it's going to become a tomb to you. It's actually going to get worse. Introvert or extrovert, it's going to get worse. I remember when, and many of you were with me during that time, when I thought my dad was dying, He actually was starting kidney failure, and you know, it's like you look at some of the stuff, it's like, oh, wow, he's not going to live very long. So I went into this deep depression. What I didn't know was that he also had stage 4 cancer that was yet to be diagnosed. And so I thought he had like 2 or 3 years or 4. You know, I was over dramatizing. Everybody said, no, you can live on dialysis for years. Well, yeah, if you don't have stage 4 prostate cancer, but that's what he had. So anyway, you know, I would talk to my dad, you know, going to work, coming home from work. I mean, I don't know anyone who was closer to their father than I was, although I'm sure many are. And I was just going through that, and I wanted just to sit in my office. I just wanted to be left alone. But the longer I was there, the worse it got. And I did something. I started going to the daycare and playing. It made all the difference. I mean, that was the best time of my day. That actually really helped. Avery Bailey was there. She was 3. Avery doesn't know a stranger. And she knew me. So I would go in and sit down, and she would start by messing up your hair, all in your face, and by the time it was over, she'd be riding you like a horse, and she was like the gang of all the little midgets, and they would all be taking rides. It just helped to go over and give horseback rides to the kids. just help. You have to get up. You have to rediscover what God's calling is on your life. And you can't shut people out, even though you might be wired to completely shut them out. It's not going to get better that way. It's not going to get better. And people need to be given what you have anyway. Your pain is meant to help somebody else. It is. The pain in your life is medicine for somebody else. So don't sit on the medicine. You've got to reach out to other people. And then fourth, not only does he say, get up, go, get busy, do what I've called you to do, Elijah. Elijah, get out of the cave, go find Elisha. He'll be your accountability partner. Be with you. But fourth, I think, maybe even the greatest point is this. I think he's saying, and be thankful, Elijah. Because here's Elijah, and he sees everything that's wrong. And to him, everything's wrong. But God comes in and he says, Elijah, your perspective is off. Because there's a lot good. In fact, you think it's all lost, and in a matter of a few weeks, Elijah, Ahab is going to be defeated. You think it's all wrong, but there are forces already at work that's going to bring about what you've been praying about. It's not all bad, Elijah. It's not. In fact, it's almost all good, Elijah. It really is, because all the things you're concerned about are about to get fixed. And I think that part of the reason God is telling him that is to say, Elijah, you ought to be a lot more grateful than you are in this moment. And that's extremely important for you and I. It doesn't matter what has happened. There's still, on our worst day, far more to be thankful for than to be depressed about. There really is. There really is. You look at your life and listen. You live this long. You have. It's nice to live this long. You have been blessed. I mean, you walked in here. All of it doesn't work, but enough of it worked for you to get in here. You probably slept in a bed last night. And most of you probably had heat. Nobody in here looks like they're starving. My guess is you got stuff in the refrigerator when you go home. Maybe you don't, but nobody. You know what? One of the worst things, and I've read about this, one of the worst things that could happen to a parent is to look at your children, and millions of parents are facing this today, to look at your children and know that they are hungry and not have any food to give them. How awful that would be. But there's never been a day in my life when that's been true of me. I've always had something to give to my kids. I mean, if you're young, just shut up. I mean, Donald Trump is worth $3 billion. I guarantee you, he'd give you $3 billion if he could be 20 again. Look at anybody with lots of money. They would gladly give you all the money they have if they could trade places with you, because your youth is much more valuable than anything else in the world. You're the richest person in the room. The youngest person is the richest person in the room, because you got something money won't buy. And man, I wish everybody would love to find the fountain of youth. I mean, what have you got to be thankful for? You know, that's the question of what? 2 Kings chapter 4. Elisha comes to the widow of Zarephath. Her husband died. Two sons, they're about to take the two sons into slavery because the family is in debt and they're going to have to work off the debt. Elijah comes to the widow, and what does he say? You know that one. What do you have? Now, I see what's wrong. You lost your husband. You're about to lose your sons. You're bankrupt. Your security is gone. I get all that, but what do you have? She said, I've got a flask of oil. And he said, well, that's enough. That's enough. And he said, go out, borrow all the pots, come back. And as she started to put oil in all the pots, they filled up. It was enough money to get out of the debt and to keep her sons with her. It didn't bring her husband back, but it got her security and her boys back. The question is always, what do you have? That's the important question. I remember again when my dad was in his last weeks, it was a real struggle. I remember calling Pastor Rudd, and we were having a conversation. I didn't call just to cry on his shoulder. I had something, but I meant to cry on his shoulder. But I was about something else. But anyway, the conversation turned, and I said, I want you to pray for me. My dad's not doing well, and this is very hard. And he said to me, he said, well, Nathan, if I were you, I would just be thankful. He said, because you have a good dad, and you've had him for a long time, and I never got to meet my dad. I would have loved to have a dad like yours. And I didn't want to hear that. So I got, is that all you got, Pastor? And but later on that day, I talked to another older pastor friend in Ohio, and I told him the same thing, you know. And he said, well, he said, I really can't identify with you, Nathan. He said, because my dad abandoned my family when we were three, left my mom and my brother and I. And I never had a relationship with him. I would just love to have a father like you had. And it's like, oh, yeah, that's no good either. But what God was saying to me through two other men of God was, you ought to be thankful you had a good dad. You're about to lose your dad, but a lot of people didn't have a dad like yours, and a lot of people would have loved to have a dad like yours. So you ought to be thankful for what you had. And again, that's, listen, sometimes people will say, you need to pray. Pray. Talk to God. You got a hurt. You got a need. Pray. Take it to the Lord in prayer. That's true. And you ought to pray. But it matters how you pray. Remember the guy in the temple, and he's down there praying. And he says, Lord, thank God I'm not like all these other people. And Jesus said, that guy's prayer didn't get him anywhere. By that prayer, he proved his unrighteousness. It's not enough to pray. In fact, The wrong kind of praying makes it worse. Remember Ben Hogan, the great golfer, who was a very straight-spoken kind of guy? Somebody was talking, and they said in a conversation with Ben Hogan, they said something about practice makes perfect, and he snapped at him, and he said, that's the dumbest saying in the world, practice makes perfect. He said, perfect practice makes perfect. If you practice the wrong thing, you're making it worse. If your golf swing isn't what it should be, you're only reinforcing the bad habits. Practice makes perfect if it's perfect practice. Otherwise, it'd be better that you not practice. That's the way it is with prayer. And how does the Bible say we ought to pray? Look at the Philippians chapter 4. You know this one. Rejoice in the Lord always. Again, I say rejoice. Let your gentleness be known to all men. The Lord is at hand. Be anxious for nothing, but in everything by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God. And the peace of God, which surpasses all understanding, will guard your hearts and minds through Christ Jesus. Now that's the point. Prayer doesn't lead to peace if it's not done with rejoicing and thanksgiving. Praying and getting down and saying, Lord, you see the pain in my life? You see the hurt in my life? I don't know why you let this come into my life. I've tried to serve you. I've done what I thought I ought to do. And look what has happened to my life. You can pray like that, but it won't lead to peace. Prayer that leads to peace is saturated with thanksgiving and rejoicing. You got to start there. And really, that means just praying and telling the truth. Go ahead and tell God what hurts. But tell God what hurts after you say, Lord, I don't deserve Jesus Christ. I don't deserve Jesus' blood. So many times in my life, when I was lost, I could have died and I could have gone to hell. But you are merciful to me. You help me. It's only by your grace I'll make heaven my home. It's only by the blood of Christ, which I don't deserve. I don't deserve any of that. I don't deserve your presence. I don't deserve your grace in my life. Even after I came to Christ, when I look at all I've done for you and all you've done for me, I feel my unworthiness to the core, and yet you bless me. You start there. Tell the truth. Tell the truth. And the truth is that you don't deserve anything you got. Everything you got is a blessing. And you have been blessed to the point of being smothered. And then say, but you see my pain. But it's going to take you an hour to talk about the blessings. And then by the time you talk about the blessings, when you get around to talking about your pain, you'll have enough faith to say, but I know you'll help me because look how you've helped me in the past. You'll help me. I mean, you helped me the whole way. You have spared me and spared me and spared me and spared me and spared me. And you've allowed this to come into my life and it hurts and it feels like it's going to crush me. But there's no doubt that you love me. There's no doubt that you care about me. So there's no doubt that, and I don't understand, but I don't have to understand it. I know you. I know you. You know, Miss Einstein was once asked about theory of relativity that Albert Einstein had, formulated that, I guess, won lots of prizes and revolutionized the world. And they asked her if she understood it. And she said, no, but I know my husband and I trust my husband, and if he came up with it, it's right. It's like, I don't have to understand what's going on, but I know the person who allowed it to come in, and I know his character. And I know he doesn't make mistakes. Just come in. Got to have a spirit of thanksgiving in our lives. You stay in that cave long enough, it becomes your grave. Bible says we got to get up. Got to get up. This coming week, don't stay down. Don't stay down. Some of you are watching me. The introverts are watching me. The depressed introverts are still in bed. I feel you. I know. I'm not a prophet, but I know where you are today. And you're probably going to watch me later. Don't stay in that bed. Get up. If God has saved you, He's called you to do something. Do it. Connect with other people, even though you don't want to in the beginning. Connect with other people. God has given us each other. Rediscover what it means to be thankful. Rediscover what it means to be thankful. Stand with me.